The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Today, Apple shares tick higher after CNBC broke the story on its latest moves to produce a self-driving electric car.
We are here today to introduce our proposal to cancel $50,000 in student debt.
That whole narrative of the little guys taking on the big guys, well, it got a little muddied this week. Retail traders were net sellers last Tuesday through Thursday. So who was the one buying? Well, much of that activity was driven by hedge funds riding the momentum higher. And one fund called Senvest Management has been long GameStop for a few months and crystallized $700 million gains when the stock hit its peak. BlackRock, too, which as recently as last week owned 13% of the company, may be sitting on significant paper gains.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Washington is working on a new $2 trillion stimulus program as Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen urging Biden to go big on stimulus and fix a slowing economy. All of this adding up to new records for the stock market this week and a rise in interest rates. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck in the first hour, Frank Barbera is our technician this week. Frank thinks stock prices could head higher, and gold stocks are really looking attractive. Also later on in the program, Dan Steffens will join us as we take a look at the case for higher energy. Even Goldman Sachs has raised its estimates to $65 for WTI. And Chris Sheridan and I will take a look at why we think we've begun a new super cycle in commodity prices. Finally, Ryan Poplava will be here to tell us what moved the markets this week. Ryan?
The U.S. stock market made a valiant recovery this week, closing at all-time highs for most of the averages. The S&P 500 rallied 4.7% this week, five straight days in a row to hit a new high Friday. Stocks bounced back from last week's dip as investors took the opportunity to buy back in on reduced contagion fears caused by the short squeeze mania last week, despite the shift to silver on Monday. Focus this week returned to economic developments, presumed additional stimulus from the government, improved vaccine distribution throughout the year, and the understanding that the Federal Reserve will not be raising interest rates anytime soon. So every sector is up this week, being led by the pro-cyclical sectors. Energy up 8.25%. Then financials and communications were both up 6.7%, followed by technology up 4.9% and materials up 4.1%. The risk-on trade is back, with stocks leading the way. The risk-off sentiment has subsided, as was seen in the volatility index that has fallen back to 20 from a high near 37 a week ago, and a 10-year treasury yield that has risen back up to 1.15%. So let's take a look at some of the economic developments this week. It's the first week of the month, so there's usually a lot of important data to review, including the ISM numbers and jobs data. So on Monday, the CNBC published a report that the Congressional Budget Office sees GDP growth will recover rapidly to pre-pandemic size mid-2021 and believes the labor force is forecast to rebound to its pre-pandemic level in 2022. They also said these projections were not based on any assumption of new stimulus. Regarding that, the GOP senators made a $600 billion proposal, but Biden said he is committed to his $1.9 trillion stimulus bill. The S&P 500 rose 1.6% on Monday on that news, as well as the news that the ISM manufacturing numbers slipped to 58.7 but remains at healthy levels despite all the shutdown measures. ISM services were reported on Wednesday, rising to 58.7 as well in January, showing that acceleration was there despite political tumult and shutdown measures. Initial jobless claims declined 33,000 to 779,000 for the week ending January 23rd, showing improvement, but not enough to quiet the calls for additional stimulus. Friday's report that non-farm payrolls increased 49,000 in January painted a similar picture as the initial jobless claims. Improvement, but not enough to scratch the need for more stimulus. This week's earnings announcements had a few highlights I'd like to share. UPS followed robust numbers seen from FedEx in December with a 52-cent beat, to earnings. Revenues rose 21% year-over-year, with an additional 2 weeks of shopping compared to the shortened calendar in 2019 between Cyber Week and Christmas Week. UPS additionally did a lot to help pull forward any kind of demand it could from its customers, away from its peak weeks. And unfortunately, UPS did not get back to providing guidance on forward earnings, but it didn't seem to detract from the positive shareholder reaction seen there. Alphabet was one of the lead stars of the show this week, having heard great advertising results from Facebook. Expectations were high. The company crushed earnings expectations, coming in at $22.30 versus $15.98, its largest margin in over 5 years. Total advertising revenue jumped 22% in the fourth quarter to $46.2 billion, with a 47% surge in YouTube revenue to $6.9 billion. Ad revenue wasn't the only source of growth. Its cloud revenue increased 46%, and they pulled the curtain away on this segment, saying it isn't quite profitable yet. They are heavily investing for growth, having tripled the size of its sales force. It eventually hopes to hit scale and will then focus on margins in the years ahead. Shares finished the week at new all-time highs. There were some negative reactions to some of the earnings highlights this week. One of them is Qualcomm, whose sales were up nicely, 79% year-over-year, to $4.2 billion. But the CEO believes a delayed iPhone 12 launch will be answered by ramped-up activity in the first quarter of this year. The CEO highlighted their unique position in 5G due to the company's RF front-end chips, with sales that surged 157% in the quarter over last year. The company is also highly focused in the automotive industry, with an eye towards cars being more connected, electric, and autonomous in the future, with 5G playing a large role. Its automotive segment saw sales rise 44% to $212 million and projects the segment will be at $1.5 billion in the next few years. I'd love to dig into Amazon's earnings, which were exceptional, but the biggest story there was the announcement that Jeff Bezos would step down as CEO and transition into executive chair in the third quarter, and we saw a negative reaction to that news. That's it for this week's wrap-up, highlighted by short squeeze stocks reverting to the mean, better than expected earnings, economic data that was good or good enough to further a stimulus bill, and then, of course, rising vaccine rates as seen through many results we've been hearing this week, which end result saw the market rise to all-time highs for the S&P 500 and many of the other indices.
Underlying inflation trends argue that the Fed likely won't tighten until 2025. That means that the Fed will be remaining loose and providing ample liquidity to the markets for many years to come. That is the assessment from Jim O'Sullivan, chief U.S. macro strategist at TD Securities, named by MarketWatch as one of the most accurate economic forecasters for the past 12 years. This week on FS Insider, he provided an in-depth outlook on the U.S. economy, inflation, Fed liquidity, the U.S. consumer, and more. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
Based on the cycle the last time, it would be 2025 before they actually raise rates. And for now, clearly inflation is too low from their perspective. The Fed's framework right now is that they're not just waiting for the real economy to improve. They're not just waiting for so-called maximum employment. I mean, they're waiting for inflation to pick up as well, and not just arguably go to 2%. They want to go above 2%, at least for the tightening part, not necessarily the tapering. So, I mean, that could all potentially result in inflation being too high out several years, but it's all kind of set up for highly accommodative policy and basically encouraging people to borrow really for the next couple of years at least.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the program is Frank Barbera. He's Senior Portfolio Manager at Financial Sense Wealth Management. Frank, let's begin with the S&P and the major indexes. Take it from the top. What do you see?
Right now, the S&P with today's close, we're close around 3871 today on the S&P 500, up about 1.1%. You know, very strong close, basically up to a new all-time high. You can look at it a couple of ways. Behind the stock market, underneath the stock market, breadth of late has been lagging a little bit. But right now, I would say, you know, all in all, it's not enough to be concerned about. The S&P is, you know, comfortably above a rising trend line that goes back to the October 30th lows. Those lows were around 32, 33. And if you just draw a trend line up from that low to from the October lows of last year, across the lows that we saw a few days ago at 36.94, that was on the 24th of this January, that trend line comes in around 37, 34. And at the same time, the 50-day average is at 37, 35. So the S&P has a lot of support, roughly 3% below where it is. And I would say before, you know, until it reversed and broke that, you know, it would not be a good idea to be getting bearish. This is a market that's shown a very powerful move up over the last 12 months since last March's low. That uptrend to me still looks like it's in effect. We're above a rising 50-day average. And I would have to say at this stage of the game, given the fact that the Fed is still very accommodative, they're still printing a lot of money, there's still stimulus. The only thing I think that could really derail the stock market and the one story I would be keeping an eye out as we go forward would be the South African strain of the coronavirus. So far, as per the United States, that hasn't been widespread, and it isn't a story that's taking on a headline dimension. I think if that were to get, you know, take on a larger role in the headlines, that could be an excuse for the stock market to possibly pull back, especially if we started seeing more lockdowns and, you know, a reversal. Right now, a lot of restaurants in Los Angeles, I can tell you, and other cities are opening up for the first time in a very long time. So that's sort of heading in the right direction towards growth. And I think the market has correctly looked through some of the weakness in the economy over the last few months and is pushing higher. I think it would take something pretty negative on the virus front to really derail the market. Right now, the leadership is still, it's definitely concentrated leadership, but the charts on those leaders are still intact, the FANGs. And I would say right now the trend is up on the S&P 500 and on the NASDAQ, and I just wouldn't be fighting that trend. If we see something more than a 3% decline in the S&P that begins to hang for a week or two, maybe there's a point there where you could get a correction, but I think that's a little premature as things stand right now.
Frank, how would you contrast the present movement in the S&P last year coming out of the bear market that was fast and furious? It was the technology stocks. It was the what I call the COVID stocks, your Zooms, stocks like that. It was a sort of a stay-at-home and a handful of tech stocks that dominate, and they still continue to do this. If you take a look at Apple's earnings, if you take a look at Microsoft, I mean, they blew them right out of the water. Do you see this broadening, or is it still a large handful of stocks that are still leading the index?
Yeah, you know, it still seems to be a concentrated group. It is broadening out. We've seen a move into the Russell. The Russell has taken out the leadership. We've also seen small cap stocks really coming alive. So I think in general, we have seen the broad market pick up. Deep cyclical stocks are moving pretty nicely. So I'd say at the moment, you know, the health of the market is okay. It's okay to pretty good, somewhere in between there. It has not deteriorated a lot. The valuations are truly scary. You would wonder if anything were to change the course on Fed policy, like inflation picking up, which I think we could see later this year, then maybe at some point that could become a problem for the market. But I think right now there's too much strength in some of these big leaders: Microsoft, Amazon, Apple. A lot of these stocks are, you know, they look like they want to try and move higher. And I would continue. I'm really focusing a lot in. I see second level groups of tech stocks that are trying to make the information technology space that are looking like they're trying to move higher. Some telecoms, even the utilities. I see a lot of groups where there's some relative values, some good yield, and I'm finding places that are attractive to put money. And where, you know, we can earn a steady and consistent total return.
Frank, I want to talk about something within the S&P. And we saw this briefly for a period of time last year, where you had not only consumer discretionary, but consumer staples all leading in the same direction. Normally, they go in the opposite direction. If people are going in discretionary, they're out of staples. Now we take a look at discretionary is doing very good, betting on a recovery, and staples are sort of correcting here. What's your take on these two sectors?
Well, right now the discretionary stocks look extended to me, so I think I'd be maybe scraping some money off the table there. And the consumer staples have had a nice pullback, and I think I kind of think we might move into some kind of consolidation, maybe a high level consolidation in the stock market, where it really doesn't come down, but it continues to hold at higher levels, maybe make some nominal new higher highs, but that the pace of the rally might slow a little bit. And so I think within that, you can pick through the consumer staple area and find some pretty good values. I've been eyeballing individual names, things like Smucker's, Jam, General Mills. There are some stocks out there that look, you know, they look fairly depressed. Kellogg's, you know, there might be some low risk entry points shaping up. That's not to recommend any of those stocks, but just to put a point on your idea, I think the staples, even Coca-Cola has had a pretty decent sized sell off. You can go through that space and see a lot of oversold readings where the charts seem to be setting up for a turn, and that's definitely caught my eye.
Let's go to another sector, and let's talk about interest rates, Frank. It's hard to believe that last August we were below 0.5% on 10-year treasuries, and we got all the way down to almost 1.25% on the 30-year bond. Fast forward to today, you got 30-year at 1.92%. And you've got the 10-year breaking out above 1% at 1.15. Where do you see interest rates going here?
Well, that's, Jim, on the long bond, that's one of the markets that seems to be getting into some serious technical trouble. We ended today right around 1.93%. And over the last 2 days, we've seen the price of, let's say, for example, the TLT ETF. That has drifted to new lows, definitive new lows below 149.90, down to about 149.20. And the 30-year bond, at the 30-year bonds, actually at 193, it's coming right up against the March 18th, 2020 highs and yield. The high was around 194. That's a very big juncture for the 30-year bond yield. And it's an area that 194 yield is a critical spot. If we push through that, I think yields could move towards 210 to 215. I don't think they're going to go a lot higher than the 210, 215 area over the next week or two. We could actually see a pullback to around 175 over a period of a couple of weeks. But I think in the bigger picture, if we do push up over 2% in the next, let's say, week or two, that might be the beginning, really the early signal that this very long downtrend in yields that we've seen now for so many years is beginning to change, and that the bond market is turning definitively more bearish. So to me, the bonds are looking a lot more bearish. Right now, they're right up against the one-year upper Bollinger band on the 30-year bond. At 1.93 today, that band was at 1.94%. And you know, generally speaking, when yields start pushing up and outside that one-year band, that's a sign that you're really getting a definitive change in trend. So the fact that we're moving above the highest peak in yields since March of last year, all of this is suggesting that the bond market is getting itself into maybe some trouble. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we're probably going to see a pickup of inflation in the months ahead. And so in my view, I think inflation is headed higher. I think the bond market is now starting to price that in, and we're starting to see yields adjust upward, to compensate for that. It's going to be interesting to see if at some point the Fed comes out with yield curve control on either the 10 or the 30-year bond. If they do, that would be a point in my mind where I would think that the Fed balance sheet would really start to pick up. And that's a point where we'll probably see gold really start to move bananas on the upside.
Well, speaking of inflation, let's move over to the commodity space, which personally I'm heavily invested in. So let's begin with precious metals. What's your take on gold, which has been falling recently?
It certainly had a sharp down day today. I think gold, the decline in gold is now starting to look like it's coming into a climactic low. We're really back down to the same levels we saw in mid to late November of last year on both the GLD ETF and the physical price of gold around 1788 on the spot gold. The November lows were right around 1764 last year. This is an area on the chart where there's a lot of support. If you go back to the March lows of 2020, gold was around $1,455 an ounce, and then the August high was around $2,075. If you did a 50% retracement of that whole move, that comes in at $1,764, and again today we're right around $1,788. So we're almost 50% of the way back of last year's big bull run. And if you go to the very, very low from the year prior, we were at a 0.382 Fibonacci retracement, also comes in right around the 1765 area from the absolute lows over the last 2-3 years in gold to the absolute high. We retraced around 38%. So this is an area where both the GLD and the spot price are probably going to dig in over the next couple of days. I keep an indicator called the selling intensity gauge, which tracks the amount of down volume over time, that's concentrated down volume that's taking place in the metals, and that is spiking up. That was around, when it's usually over 2.3, that's usually a sign that you're getting very close to a bottom. We were at 1.96 last night, and when I run the numbers today, I really wouldn't be surprised to see a reading close to 2.3 by the end of the day today. That's kind of consistent. I think we're very close with the yellow metal with an important low. It really wouldn't surprise me to see gold dig in here and then begin a nice trading rally. And ultimately, that trading rally should evolve into another leg up and a more powerful uptrend on the weekly chart. So it's a little early. You know, when you're looking for a low, there's two parts. The first part is the market's getting oversold. Once you see that fear bottom, the next thing to watch for is an upside trend reversal where you get some bullish confirmation. I think we're about there on the fear bottom. We've got, you know, high level of puts to calls in gold, high level of puts to calls in some of the mining stocks. And now what we want to watch very carefully over the next few days is, is there strength developing in the space? Is money starting to rotate back in? And do we start getting some trend following buy signals that confirm a new move up? That's what's ahead. That hasn't happened yet, but we'll be keeping our eyes on that as we move forward.
And finally, let's talk about some of the base metals, Frank, because the Biden administration is going all out green. They're talking about an infrastructure, $2 trillion spending on green energy investments. Well, all that green energy requires copper, nickel, and silver. So let's talk about base metals.
Sure, sure. Well, the copper price had a huge move from last March, lows down near $2 a pound, all the way up to around $3.70 a pound, just right around January 8th. It's been consolidating. Jim, I think that kind of huge run, both in copper and in zinc, some of these other base metals, is going to deserve some time moving sideways, a little bit more consolidation. But right now, when you look at that whole sector, they're consistently above, 50-day moving averages. They're above trend lines. So technically, they're in a positive medium-term trend. I think what we've entered is essentially a consolidation phase, maybe a high-level consolidation phase, where prices just move giant sideways for a while, and then we'll see another breakout. Silver is the one that really kind of got monkeyed around with a little bit with last week's big surge on Reddit. We saw silver surge as high on the spot price as $30.09 on Monday of this week. That's come back down to $26.15 right now. That whole run started back on January 27th at a low of $24.70. So we went from $24.70 to just a little over $30. I wouldn't be surprised to see silver wash out a little bit more over the next couple of days. We could get back down and test 24. That's a key level I'm watching on the chart. But I did notice today a lot of the silver stocks, they've given back most of that sort of speculative move up, and they're not as attractive as the gold stocks. So I think, again, silver stocks, everything silver is probably going to lag a little bit behind because they hyperextended in the short term, and they're going to need a little more time to base. But the silver stocks have retraced quite a bit, and they're beginning to get to levels that at least look, okay, a little bit more palatable. The gold stocks, on the other hand, are way depressed in sympathy with the metal, and I see a lot of deep oversold readings on the gold stocks. So that's where right now I'm focusing on some of the gold stocks that are growing their dividends, because a lot of companies have pretty low all-in sustaining costs, and with the gold price where it is, free cash flow is really moving up. And some of the management in various companies like Newmont, Barrick, B2 Gold, there are a few that really stand out, Kirkland Lake. They're trying to boost the dividend and hand back excess cash flow in part to shareholders. And so what I think we're beginning to see is a rising dividend cycle on the gold stocks, not too different than what we saw in the late 1970s when inflation moved up and the same sort of huge excess free cash flow situation set up back, if you can remember back to like 1978, 1979, when I was at Financial News Network and the Business Channel, we used to run boards on South African gold stocks, things like Blyvooruitsite, Durban Deep, Driefontein, Western Deep Levels, Western Areas, and all those stocks were paying 5, 6, 7% dividends. I think that's ultimately where we're going in the gold space. And so right now you want to be watching which management is being generous and rewarding shareholders with positive increases in the dividend. And a couple of them are really trying pretty hard.
Frank, I want to talk about where we're going, let's say in this decade and what you see in the market. And what I'm talking about here is for almost half a century in this business, we have what we call the 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And the idea was if you go through a bear market as we did in 2000 or 2007, your stocks went down, but your bonds went up and it created a balance so you didn't take as big of a hit. When I take a look at where interest rates got last summer, where you saw, the 10-year Treasury get down to below 0.5%. I'm just looking at some of these bond funds like TLT. My goodness, this isn't working anymore. So what does this imply going forward?
I couldn't agree more. I think really ultimately where it's going, Jim, and this is, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but we've seen a really huge speculative wave over the last few years, which has just moved completely towards passive investing, index returns. And I think we're going to see a lot more. We may continue to see a bull market over the next, you know, year, 18 months. I could make a pretty good case right now that the S&P 500 could actually hyperextend straight up here towards readings near 5,000 or 5,200 over the next 6 to 7 months. And so we could actually end up in a very red hot stock market. But whether that happens or not, I think at some point, this long move in what has been effectively 25 years towards passive investing is going to come to an end. And we're going to see a market that's a lot choppier, a lot more volatile. The bond market, I think, is going to be an early victim of this with rising yields. And so you won't have that inverse correlation where the bonds are moving up as equities are moving down and it's providing some padding. My attitude at this stage of the game and what I've been really coming at this from last few years is effectively tactical investing. I think you go through these cycles. For example, in 1966, we concluded a 25-year cycle to the upside, which was all passive investing. It ended with the go-go era, very hot mutual funds, everybody crowding into those funds. And that was followed from 1966 to 1982 with the Dow moving sideways for 16 years between 1,000 and 500, but inflation picking up during that entire period of time. Inflation went from 2% to 4% to 6% to 15% over that period of time. And that period of time came to be what was called the invisible crash, where in constant dollar terms, equities adjusted for the rate of inflation were actually going down. And so in that period of time, you had to be very strategic in the right sectors. If you were in oil service, if you were in gaming, if you were in gold, you were fine. If you were in consumer staples, you were fine. But if you were in retail, utilities, other areas, you really got chopped up. Technology went for a long time where it wasn't doing very much. I think we're going to see something akin to that, you know, at least something that rhymes with that over the next decade or maybe a little bit more, where we see inflation moving up, the dollar under a lot of pressure. The speed with which that could happen is hard to gauge, but based on what I see with policies and very large deficits, my concern is that the dollar is near a high right now. In fact, I would actually make a case the dollar could be near a very important pivot high as we speak and about to begin another sustained decline. So I think that kind of dovetails with what we're seeing in the bottom in gold. I think we're going to move into a different environment where you're really going to need an element of timing and a tactical overlay to mitigate downside risk. So I think we're going to see a big sea change in the way it's going to move back towards active management over time.
Frank, as we close, you've recently joined Financial Sense Wealth Management as a senior portfolio manager. Tell our listeners if they'd like to find out more about your work and what you're doing. How could they do so, please?
Sure. They can call the company 487-3939, and that's the 888-858 phone number. I am starting continuing what I have been doing for 5 years with Financial Sense, which is a conservative. There's actually a couple of programs, but the one we're focused on right now is what we call conservative income. And Jim, you know, for right now, for a lot of people, the Fed policy that we've seen over the last few years it's continued to depress short-term interest rates. And keeping short-term interest rates near zero has effectively taken away what for many people was the option of a five-year CD yielding 4%. People used to use that as a way of predicting their income on a steady investment. And so it's actually forced people into the capital markets, and it's forced them to chase yield. And we've seen across the spectrum, high-yield bond spreads, for example, have been compressing down towards historic lows. There's a lot of risk out there. And so what I'm doing is I have a tactical overlay over a wide variety of bond categories and other asset classes, including some gold. And what we do is we sprinkle that into a very widely diversified pie chart where every single asset class has a trailing stop loss. So the goal here, the whole portfolio, the conservative income portfolio, is being managed to the twin goals of, number one, trying to achieve a compound return between 5 to 7%. Over the last 5 years, it's compounded at about 5.5. And at the same time, to keep downside risk no more than 3 to 4%. So the reason for this, it has everything to do with the demographic. When you look at the United States, the baby boomers, right now they control 54% of U.S. household wealth. They control 57% of U.S. affluent wealth. And right now they're retiring about 10,000 per day, about 70,000 per week, and about 260,000 to 280,000 per month. So we have the country's largest demographic, two decades worth of births, about 75 million people that are coming into their retirement years. And as people age, there's a little bit of an issue with buy and hold. When you're young, if you're young and you're 25 and you're 30, and you've got your whole working career in front of you, you can take a lot of risk. You can handle a 50% bear market in the stock market because you know you're going to have plenty of income coming in during the course of your career, God willing, and you'll have time to recover and actually buy lower. So when you're young, buy and hold is really, I think, a reasonable strategy. But what I've noticed in working with a number of families over the years is that as people, you know, get a little bit more mature, as they reach the end of their working career, they naturally get more conservative. And to go through something like a 55% drawdown, like we saw between 2008 and 2009 in the stock market, where it's month after month after month, that creates tremendous psychological stress on investors. And usually most investors can't buy and hold through that. So the trick is to keep losses very small. When you have a percentage decline of, let's say, 2 or 3%, that's not a big deal. If you make 3 or 4%, you get that money right back. But percentage losses are asymmetric. If you lose 50%, you have to make 100% to get that money back. And for people who are, let's say, in their 70s or their mid-70s, if they have to go through a 30, 40% decline, number one, that's a lot of stress. And number two, you don't know exactly how long it's going to take to get that money back to even. So what the program does is it has a trailing stop. It has this big risk mitigation overlay where the goal is to generate income, generate total return. And I know right now people are focused on income, but it's really total return that they need. They need that 5 to 7% goal, and that's what we're targeting with this product, is to get people a conservative return without getting them hurt if the capital markets reverse. And since nobody has a crystal ball, the best you can do is keep an eye on the trends. And when the trends start to reverse, you get out of the way and you cut the losses short. And that's what we do.
So, Frank, one more time, if people would like to get in touch with you, how could they do so, please?
Sure. They should give Financial Sense a call, 858-487-3939. It's a Financial Sense conservative income program, and I would love to talk with anyone who's interested, who is looking for a higher return, but wants to take only measured risk. And that's what we do. We take measured risk and we get them, we try to get them those consistent returns.
Okay, Frank, before I let you go, you know I'm going to ask you this. This is Friday. It's Friday night, dude. Where are you having dinner now?
You know, actually, the funny thing is I can now go out. Jim, if you had asked me that question a week or two ago, I would have told you I'm home cooking. I do like to cook. I'll probably go down to a little cafe, maybe grab a burger later. We have a nice cafe down the street. So I love it. I'm getting out. I'm going out and having a little food. Go see some people.
All right, my friend. Take care, and we'll be talking to you soon.
If there's been any relief for consumers, it's been the price of oil. Gasoline prices are at their lowest level in a long time, but they recently have begun to rise. Will oil prices hit their previous peak? Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program is Dan Steffens from Energy Perspectives. Dan, in the last couple of days, you know, in the month of January, everybody's coming out with their forecast for the year. But we've had several on the price of commodities and especially oil. Goldman came out and they're predicting $65 oil by summer. What's behind that prediction?
Well, the economies are bouncing back. A lot of it is, you know, COVID vaccine optimism. And they are getting initial reports. Apparently, Israel has the highest percentage of population that's been vaccinated, and they've seen a pretty drastic decline in their number of cases. So that's good news. And then the economic data that's coming out, distillate demand, that's diesel, home heating oil, that demand is back to pre-pandemic levels. Gasoline's still down because that's more for mobility of people, as opposed to, you know, goods. Since everybody's at home buying stuff off Amazon, it's been creating the truck traffic. And, of course, jet fuel is going to be down, too. But we don't need to get back to pre-pandemic overall demand of 101 million barrels a day, because non-OPEC production has dropped at least 3 or 4 million barrels a day. Just in the U.S., we're down 2 million barrels a day. So supply and demand, if we, you know, if the vaccines work, we're going to get back to a very, very tight global oil market very quickly.
So when we take a look at some of these things that can push the price of oil up, I'm looking longer term in this decade because the Biden administration is coming in. They're going all green. They've stopped the Keystone Pipeline, which to me is just going to drive the price of oil up because it'll be coming by train, which is riskier. But also restriction on federal land. So that's going to put a damper on U.S. production. So if you have that and you have the globe recovering, which oil demand goes up, what I'm concerned about, Dan, and a number of people have written about this, is oil investments take a long time to bring an existing well into production. I'm not talking about shale, but, you know, the deep water, the more longer lasting projects. And one thing that's occurred in the energy industry since 2014 is the oil companies have pared back significantly their investments in new discoveries. So a lot of the oil that we have, I think the global decline rate is about 7% on depletion. So we've got to discover several Saudi Arabias just to replace what we're losing. But let's talk about the impact of lack of investment and what that might imply going forward.
Just in the United States, we've gone from about 2 years ago, we peaked at about 1,100 drilling rigs looking for oil and gas, and now we're under 400. So we're down, you know, 60, 70%. Just in the last year, we're down over 50%. And we need at least 500 rigs drilling for oil and 150 rigs drilling for natural gas just to hold our production flat. We've had recently in November, we had kind of a rebound that people see. But that's really a rebound in oil and gas production because of the for November. The last month of actual production we have is for November. It just came out last week. And that increase is really primarily 90% of it is just wells coming back online that were shut in for hurricane activity in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we had three major hurricanes move right through the center of the Gulf of Mexico that took a lot of production offline. So that's bounced back. So that's probably the peak. And it were like 11.1 million barrels a day. But we're already, just in the last weekly estimate from EIA, we're down to 10.9. And I'm expecting oil production to drop, U.S. oil production to drop by 50,000 to 100,000 barrels a day per month. And unless there's a big increase in drilling and completion activity, just our production going down. And then, like you said, on the international scale, that rig count has also been cut in half. And those projects take a lot longer, especially in deep water type stuff, a lot longer from discovery to full development. And what's happened in the last year is going to take quite a while to recover.
Well, there's something else that's also happening, and this is something that's coming from Wall Street. You have Wall Street hedge funds. You have one of the world's largest money manager, BlackRock, which controls about $9 trillion of assets, are moving into the energy space, taking seats on boards of big companies, and urging companies, everybody from BP to Exxon, to divest themselves of energy assets and become more kind of like what I call energy utilities. And let's talk about the impact about that, because one company out of the group, which was Exxon, was pursuing a different strategy. They were spending a lot of money on exploration. They made one of the largest oil discoveries in 2018. Now you have activist hedge funds that are coming in. They're using people like CalPERS to divest themselves, to put pressure on these Western oil companies to divest themselves. Dan, to me, that's a high-risk proposition, because what you're doing is placing more power with OPEC.
Yeah, that too. And also, you know, it's fine. And, I look at green energy investments. You know, I'm looking for little niche companies that'll do very well, in this transition to basically electrify everything. But you know, you can't like shut down oil and gas exploration until you have something to replace it. And wind and solar create electricity. They don't create transportation fuels. And yes, you know, they, if we get more electric vehicles, that'll lower, you know, transportation or that will, yeah, lower transportation fuel demand, but they're still a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's fleet. And we tend to look at the world through, you know, the American viewpoint, and we're only, you know, our great standard of living here, we're only 5% of the world's population. So we can do a lot of stuff, and it's not really going to have an impact on the other 95% of people on this world. So they're not going to, they don't have, these countries in Africa and stuff don't have the ability to put in giant wind farms and solar panels everywhere. So until we can replace the oil and gas energy, we can't shut it, start doing things to shut it down or quit investing in it. And from an investor standpoint, if the big majors are forced to get out of some of this exploration stuff, it makes the second tier companies, especially the pure upstream companies, a lot more valuable, because then they own more and more valuable real estate. And they're in good shape. They've survived 2020, and they're in good shape if we get oil at $5 a barrel again.
Dan, let's talk about if we go towards EVs, let's say by the end of the decade. I think it's going to take longer than the experts. I just, you know, studies have shown the average American has a car that they keep between 8 and 9 years. So if that's the case, and assume everybody today, 9 years from now, will have electric vehicle. So it's by the end of the decade. But more importantly, when I park my car in the garage at night, if you have a gasoline engine, you're not consuming any energy. If we all go to electric vehicles and we park the car in the garage and it's on the grid charging at night, where are we going to get the electricity to power this, given the fact that, like my own state of California, we're shutting down. We shut down our two nuclear power plants. Now we're buying power from nuclear power plants in Arizona. Where do we get the electricity?
Yeah, if we have no intention to build any more nukes, and if we were serious about air quality, that's where we would be going, because they have the scale that you need, you know, to replace a lot of coal-fired power plants. But that aside, the winner in this is going to be natural gas-fired power plants, because even if you have solar arrays, you have wind farms, the wind doesn't blow all the time, the sun doesn't blow all the time, and yeah, you can have these massive storage batteries or something, but you're going to have gas-fired power plants to back those up on the grid. And that's just the United States. I mean, everybody, you know, you hear about, you know, China making these, you know, laws that everybody's got to get, or half the population's got to get electric cars. Well, those electric cars are going to be charged by coal-fired power plants. Their main source of electricity is coal-fired power plants. So I don't really see how it does all that much for the air quality in the end of the day. And I agree with you. It's going to take a lot longer for the fleet to turn over than people think.
So when you look at the way we are structured right now, if you were an energy investor, energy underperformed the S&P 500, I think, 9 out of the last 11 years. What do you tell energy investors now? I mean, if you were an energy investor, hopefully you owned a high dividend paying stock, because that was about the only return you got over the last decade, because the price of the shares have gone nowhere.
Yeah, I picked Good Friday last year. That was April 10th. That is a low point for this cycle. And a lot of the stocks we follow have doubled since then, and they're, you know, up 15, 20% year to date already this year. And it's because money is starting to rotate into the sector. As we discussed, you mentioned earlier, Goldman Sachs raised their oil price forecast to $65 by July. Well, that's only 6 months away. If the price of oil goes to 65, which is exactly where it was before the pandemic, then these upstream companies that still hold a whole lot of acreage and a whole lot of really good development areas, they're going to be worth a lot more than they are now. So probably like half of the companies that I follow in my large cap model portfolio, they do pay dividends, you know, only 2 or 3% now, but they're under a lot of pressure to generate free cash flow and raise their dividends. Now, for dividend investors, also the midstream companies pay a lot higher dividends. So they pay 8, 9, 10% annual yield, some of them. And we're going to need pipelines. We're going to need storage. We're going to need, you know, processing plants forever. So they're very good investments, and the ones that are serving these key areas like the Permian Basin or Central Oklahoma or the Bakken, they're going to be needed and generate a lot of revenues.
You know, as I take a look at this and I take a look at where we're going, the policies, having our large oil companies divest themselves, lack of investment. I mean, the IEA talks about trillions of dollars that are needed in the energy space, because even if we go to EVs, Dan, we're not going to go to EV airlines, and I doubt if we're going to go to EV shipping, maybe in the long run, but not up front. So we're still going to need diesel fuel. We're still going to need jet fuel.
Right.
So mid-decade, I just see a crunch coming in the next couple of years. I don't know if anybody else sees that, but we look at this and the lack of investment. And then assuming that at some point with stimulus, you've got global economies recovering, so we're back up to that 100 million barrel a day consumption, I see higher oil prices.
Oh, yeah. Sub $50 oil is and was totally irrational. It can't work. There isn't enough areas in the world where $50 oil. Yeah, the very best acreage in the Permian Basin and, you know, and all these, you know, good plays, the very best acreage, tier one acreage, yeah, they can make money on that. But you eventually run out of tier one acreage. And another reminder to people, we are now producing oil directly from the shale. Well, shale is the source rock. There's nothing else after the source rock. So if you drain the source rock, you're kind of at the end of the line. Now, we've got decades left and, you know, to produce, but I don't see U.S. production getting back. Remember, we were pushing. We had days where we produced over 13 million barrels. That was the peak of U.S. production was November of 2019, and it went on decline after that. It declined every month for 3 or 4 months before the pandemic. It was on decline before the pandemic. And we had $65, $70 oil back then, and they couldn't hold production flat. And we had more than twice as many rigs running then also. So we're going to need a lot more wells because these shale wells, these horizontal shale wells, they frack them real hard at the beginning. They come on very strong, but a lot of them decline 50 to 70% in the first year of the rate of production. So you have to drill literally complete over 1,000 wells every month to hold production flat. And we're not doing it.
Well, sooner or later, this is going to catch up. If you were looking at this market right now and you think prices were going to head higher, where would you place your bets?
Well, the really grossly oversold upstream companies, the high-quality ones. And, you know, if these hedge fund guys, you know, they're in it to make money. I mean, their fees are based on how much money they make for their investors. And they start rotating again. I think the first phase will be to rotate into the companies that are – you know, been around for a long time, like EOG, Continental, Cimarex, Pioneer Natural Resources, that they've, you know, they're familiar with those. And the good thing is, you know, you're at the point in the year, like starting in a couple of weeks, they're all going to start putting out their audited financial statements. And in their audited financial statements are audited by engineering firms, proven reserve reports. And when you take those proven reserves and multiply them by a $55, $60 oil price, it now looks like it's coming here real quick. You can see that these companies are oversold. I mean, they're selling basically below book value, which for a going concern is impossible. The other thing is I'm more bullish on natural gas in the near term because our natural gas production has declined 3 or 4 BCF a day. And demand for U.S. gas is way up. Our LNG export facilities have been for months now running at above. We're exporting more than the design capacity. So they're pushing these export facilities really hard. And I don't think it's going to drop off this summer because the winter in Asia and Europe has made the global price of gas over $20 an MCF. So getting, you know, liquefying this gas here, getting it over to Asia or China and sell it to them for $20, you can make a lot of money off LNG exports.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at Energy Perspectives, how could they do so?
Yeah, if they'll just send me an email or send an email to energyperspectives@gmail.com, that'll go to Sabrina. She handles our member services. And she will give them a link and a promo code for 100% discount off their first year membership. We're a subscriber service. We publish reports on individual companies, and we have 3 model portfolios, growth and income. And they can get in. I think they're getting in at a good time. This is a great time for energy. So just send an email to energyperspectives@gmail.com and just tell us that they heard about it on Financial Sense.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, take care, stay safe, and come back again.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered. No matter what direction the markets take, we can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Are we at the beginning of the next commodity supercycle, similar to what we saw in prior cycles, if we think back to the 70s or even in the early 2000s after the tech bubble imploded? We have seen a recent jump in commodity prices the last few years, copper being one of the most notable commodities that we've been discussing on our show for some time, but also other ones. So Jim, let's kick things off today and give us your view on where we are in another commodity supercycle.
It's our view at Financial Sense. We're at the beginning stages of a grand super cycle for commodities, and there's going to be a number of factors driving it. And this is going to be a little bit different than what we saw in the 00 decade, where you saw the emerging economies, especially China and India, China becoming the world's manufacturing powerhouse, and the consumption of commodities that go with industrialization and manufacturing. So that's sort of what drove that. We also had a monetary element in the 00 decade, Greenspan bringing interest rates down to 1% after the bursting of the tech bubble. And then, of course, with the financial crisis, bringing interest rates to zero, which is where they are right now. So that was sort of the factors that were in place that drove commodity prices after almost a multi-decade bear market. I'm thinking of the 80s and the 90s, where commodity prices virtually went nowhere. Oil was stuck between $10 and $20 a barrel. Gold was around $250 to $300, didn't do much. And we didn't see a movement in commodities until roughly the beginning of the 00 decade and the bursting of the tech bubble. But what we're seeing coming forward and driving this super cycle is going to be driven by a multiple number of factors that we think is going to be the biggest grand super cycle ever.
So, Jim, as you mentioned, some of the last drivers we saw were the emerging markets, China being the most notable example, with them seeing double-digit rates of growth in the 2000s all the way up until they really peaked around 2011, along with commodities. What are some of the key drivers in this cycle that you're looking at?
Well, I think, you know, what happens when you go through a bear market? Companies go under, profits evaporate. Companies start cutting back on investment. When you're talking about the commodity space, that means exploration if you're oil or in mining. And the same thing if you're doing things like agriculture, whether it's fertilizer. So we have seen as a result of this decades of underinvestment, most especially probably in the energy sector beginning in 2014 when Saudi Arabia drove oil prices down, trying to drive American shale producers out of business. It backfired, flooded the markets, and we've been dealing with a decade-long bear market in oil, which I think is going to reverse, which will be another topic for another show. So decades of underinvestment. The IEA thinks that we need almost a couple trillion dollars. And what people forget about when it comes to energy is oil depletes, meaning that the oil wells that are put into production are eventually going to start declining in the output, and eventually they go dry. So depletion right now is running somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 7%. So that means just to stay even, we need to find the equivalent almost of a Saudi Arabia every single year. So, and it's not just oil. There's been decades of underinvestment in the mining sector. And, you know, when the price of gold went down as it did in 2011, we were in almost a decade-long bear market for gold as well as oil, as well as copper, nickel. So there's been underinvestment in the commodity space simply because the economics weren't there. If you can't sell a product and make a profit, you cut back production. Companies were high grading in order to make money. So they would basically take their highest grade ore and mine that because you get more output per ounce or let's say per pound of dirt. And they would do that in order to stay profitable. But now we're going to have to play catch up, Chris. And there are a number of other factors that are going to drive the demand for commodities. And right at the top of my list is green energy, because If you think green, you cannot have green without nickel, copper, and silver. If you want to talk about solar, think silver. If you want to talk EVs or electric charging stations, think copper. If you want to talk car batteries, think nickel. So this green energy is going to be a super driver of commodities because you can't have green without metals. The other factor that has been out there, and it was out there in the last decade, and what we're seeing today is the fusion of monetary and fiscal policy, which translates into dollar debasement, which is what Frank and I were talking about. Because when you had the Fed printing money, as it did following the financial crisis, a lot of the money that the Fed created stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed because the Fed started paying interest rates on reserves. Banks were in trouble due to the mortgage losses. So a lot of the money that was created did not work its way through the economy in the form of credit. Fast forward today, who's the biggest creditor on the planet? It's the U.S. government. The Biden administration is talking about almost $5 trillion of stimulus. We passed $900 billion in December under Trump. The Biden administration now is looking for $1.9 trillion in an economic COVID stimulus. And then on top of that, they're talking about a $2 trillion new Green Deal stimulus of infrastructure. And the onus of that infrastructure is going to be focused on green energy. So they're talking about, you know, the internet, they're talking about 5G, they're talking about airports, they're talking about, redoing buildings, they're talking about EVs, charging plants. All of this is going to take a tremendous amount of money that we're going to spend, and it's simply going to be monetized. And that's the whole concept behind MMT. You just simply, if you can raise debt or print money in your own currency, you don't have a problem unless inflation shows up. The other factor that's going in here is the forceful movement of environmentalism. You know, try to go out, find an oil deposit or a mining deposit and bring it into production. Today can take 10 to 15 years because of the permitting, the environmental studies, all the hoops that you have to jump through just to bring something into production. And there's never been a more anti-mining, anti-what I call fossil fuel environment as we see today. So that is going to basically limit what we can produce to meet demand. And finally, I guess if you look at a market that you have multi-trillion dollar companies, you have multiples that go from 200 to 1,000, probably the cheapest asset class on the planet right now is commodities. So if you look at all of that, there's five factors: underinvestment, green energy, fusion of monetary and fiscal policy, environmental policy, and generational low prices. And I think all of those are going to be factors that are going to drive a commodity super cycle in this decade.
Jim, I want to go back to something you said earlier, and that was that we've seen decades of underinvestment. And this ties into what you and Dan Steffens spoke about earlier in the show today, primarily when we think about oil, because right now there is this big move towards green energy, as we all know, and there's less and less investment going towards finding new oil deposits because it's just, essentially the zeitgeist has moved against the fossil fuel industry. So we're seeing less investment into fossil fuels. And at the same time, we're seeing demand really ramp up economically as the economy recovers. But the supplies are not going to be there. You see the Biden administration moving against the fossil fuel industry as well. So that is going to put, you would think, a huge hamper on the amount of productivity that we've seen, which has exploded out of the U.S. from the shale industry. So put this together for us in terms of what you're looking at with not just commodity supercycle as a whole, but also oil, as you discussed with Dan Steffens earlier.
Well, just take a look at the capital cycle. Like anything else, when something goes into decline, falling prices, the companies that produce the goods can't make a profit. So what do? They cut back on production. They cut back on exploration. They cut back on drilling. They cut back on finding new mines because you can't get the capital. I mean, if you're an energy company right now, good luck trying to get capital. So the capital cycle reversed as companies retrenched. They consolidated. Some went out of business. They couldn't make it. And so, in essence, you're cutting back supply. The other thing that you have, too, is the environmental movement, and also the green movement is coming in, and they're putting pressure. And this is coming not just from government. It's coming from Wall Street. I can think of BlackRock, the largest money manager on the planet. They manage over $9 trillion. They are coming in and trying to influence companies to divest themselves of fossil fuel assets. And you can see this with the five major big oil companies, from British Petroleum all the way to Exxon. Exxon just had, you've got an activist hedge fund manager using pension funds that are going to be putting new seats on the board of Exxon and getting Exxon to think more about green energy investments, kind of like becoming a energy utility than a fossil fuel company. So you've got two pressure points that are coming on the industry, one from government and the other one from Wall Street itself. And then finally, it's just capital scarcity. If you're an energy company right now, so many companies in the shale patch, number one, they never made money. And so, you know, investors are saying to these companies, we're not going to loan you money to go out and explore and drill and increase your production. We want to see a return of capital, whether that's increased dividends, buy back stocks, pay down debt, but it certainly isn't go out and drill and find new oil. So all of that is leading to this decade of underinvestment, which will mean as we go forward, I see a supply crunch coming in the next couple of years.
As we've been discussing on the show for, probably a year or two now, one of the big drivers, as you also just discussed, behind many of these different commodities that we've been touching upon, whether or not we're talking about copper, as you discussed in depth with Keith Barron last week, or nickel, lithium, a lot of these different things are key inputs to the green energy industry. And if there is a really big push to this area, then we're going to need way, way more than what we've used in the past. So tell us about how you are communicating to investors, to different money managers, how to invest around the green energy boom.
Well, Chris, as I take a look at the green energy boom, you know, the big thing right now is EVs, Apple's coming out with a car, Volkswagen is going to be all electric by 2027, Volvo's going there, you're seeing GM, Ford, all the companies are moving in this direction. Well, electric vehicles require four times the amount of copper, not to mention all the nickel that's used in a lot of these batteries. So that is going to drive this demand for these key base metals such as copper and nickel. And then the other thing is you've, what does that imply? If we're driving electric vehicles, that means when we pull our car in the driveway at night, we plug it in. Instead of just sitting there idle or basically with the engine turned off, you are now going to be charging. So there's going to be greater demand on the electrical grid put at night. So it's not just the EVs themselves. It's going to be the electrical charging stations. You know, there's, I don't know how many we have, something like a million gas stations around this country. You know, think of all the charging stations that they're going to have to build, which is also going to require these base metals to charge the vehicle. So instead of pulling into a gas station, you're going to have to pull into a charging station. And then on electricity, you're going to need to expand and modernize the grid system because we're going to require more electricity. I mean, just take a look at all the devices you have in your home that have to be charged, your iPhone, your iWatch, your iPad, your computers, your electrical devices that you use all the time. Well, you're plugging them in and you're charging them. Well, just think what happens when everybody now has an electric car and they're plugging it into the grid at night, charging it. So green energy is going to drive this demand for base metals. And let's put it this way. Wind and solar is not going to power the economy. We're going to need something more. I wouldn't be surprised if fusion becomes something, if natural gas power plants, nuclear power plants, that we're going to have to see those, because wind and solar are too intermittent and requires even more raw materials. And that's why I think that whether it's going to be building charging stations, if it's going to be rebuilding the grid, if it's going to be building the cars themselves, this is going to put a huge, massive demand on these raw materials.
Jim, sometimes you'll hear a narrative around investing commodities because the Fed is printing money. And we didn't see that. You know, after the 2008-2009 financial crisis, we did see massive amount of aka money printing or quantitative easing by the Fed. And yet we saw a major peak in commodities and they continued to decline even as the Fed was printing more money. So what is it different? What's different or where does that narrative go wrong?
Well, I mean, there's what makes this a little different, as I referred to earlier, is the concept of fusion, where you take fiscal policy and you merge it with monetary policy. And so, as I mentioned, in the last decade, we didn't see a lot of inflation because a lot of the money the Fed was printing remained on the Fed's balance sheet instead of working its way into the economy with credit. Well, take a look who's the biggest creditor now. It's not consumers, not corporations. It's the government who's taking money through these stimulus packages, getting the dollars into the hands of consumers to spend. And then at the same time, because of lockdowns and because of COVID, we've been restricting supply either on manufacturing side or in services. So we're giving people money to spend, restricting supply, and the government is now taking on that credit, and they're injecting money directly into the hands of consumers. We just passed a bill in December. That's a $600 check to individuals. Biden's talking about increasing that by another $1,400. So we're talking about $2,000 per individual. What are you going to do with the money? And how are you going to pay for it? Well, simply, we're going to print it. And then the other thing that we're doing is we're starting to see this shift now in market sector performance, which is favoring commodities. As Frank was talking about copper, you can take a look at nickel. You're now starting to look at oil, and we'll get to that next because I think we're heading towards an energy crunch. And all of this is going to lead to higher inflation. Is it going to be hyperinflation? I don't think so. But inflation rates are definitely going to be going up. And at some point, because the debt levels are getting so large, they're going to devalue the currency. You'll just wake up one day and the dollar will be down by 50%. It'll be formally devalued. And that's just going to raise the price of things. Think of real estate, think of commodities, think of stocks. And so monetary fusion is now going to be driving another factor. So we've got five or six forces that are going to drive this. Where in the 00 decade, it was emerging markets and money printing. Now it's a factor of fivefold, where you've got green energy, you've got things like underinvestment, you've got monetary fiscal policy, environmentalism, and generational lows in commodity prices that restricted or caused supply to fall.
As we discussed earlier, you know, the environmental movement, the push towards green energy is playing a very large role in this as well. And that's also leading to higher energy costs. We've seen oil pick up pretty strongly, and it appears, if you know what you and Dan Steffens discussed earlier, that that is likely to continue, especially if we see the economy recover and we see a dwindling of supplies with lack of reinvestment, productivity falling in the shale sector, and a number of these other things. So let's talk about where the environment fits into this and how you are investing around this.
Well, let's begin with the Biden administration with the executive orders. They killed the Keystone Pipeline. You know, Chris, it's not going to stop the flow of oil. It'll just make it more expensive. Instead of flowing through the pipeline, it'll flow through Buffett's Burlington Northern, which is far more costly and even riskier from an environmental point of view, or restricting drilling. So once again, restricting supply. And, you know, the other thing that it's not just oil, it's mines. I mean, you just can't go out. A friend of mine was involved in a gold project in Northern California trying to bring a rich gold deposit into production because, you know, everybody remembers California, the gold rush of 1848. California has a lot of gold minerals in the state, but they couldn't bring it into production due to environmental restraints. So it's restricting the supply of raw materials, the very raw materials we're going to need to go green. We need more copper. We need more nickel. We need more silver. And that takes mines, and it takes between the regulations and restrictions. And Chris, I saw this firsthand. We built a custom home going back. We started this project in 2013. Chris, it took us one year to go through permitting. We had to go through the city. We had to go through the fire department because of the fire hazards. We had to go through regional environmental agencies. And so it took almost a year to get permitted to build a house. And then because of all the restrictions that were put on, it took a year and a half to build it. We were recently going to build a guest house, and I was told instead of a year to get a permit, that has now gone to 14 months with higher permitting fees. All of that gets added into the cost. And so if you add more regulations and place more restrictions, simple answer, it drives up prices. And so that's going to add another element to commodity pricing going forward.
Well, Jim, you had a really good interview with Frank Barbera earlier today, and you discussed the 60-40 asset allocation, how that's no longer working. Can you give us some investment thoughts around investing in this next super cycle, the key drivers that you mentioned that are propelling this forward, and how that relates to really just your average investor out there that has, 60% equities, 40% bonds? How does this relate to them?
Well, if you take a look at the last decade, where'd you make money? You made money in passive indexing. I don't care if you bought stocks, you bought bonds, everybody made money. In this decade, what's out of favor right now? Energy. What's out of favor right now? Commodities, precious metals. And so number one, they're cheap. They're under-owned by investors. Just take a look at what the energy sector. It's hard to believe, Chris, that if you went back 4 or 5 years ago, this will go to show you. I'm reading a book right now on investing in a super cycle. If you looked in, the book was written in 2016, and they were talking about the top 10 companies that made up the index, and these were tech companies. Microsoft had a value of somewhere around $80 billion. I think Apple was $150 billion. You take a look at these companies now, they're worth trillions of dollars, over a trillion for Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple, all these companies, the FANG stocks. So this is out of favor. And when something's out of favor, eventually capital gets reallocated, and I can see capital coming back into the sector. The other thing that I think is not going to work, as Frank and I talked about, is this 60-40 allocation, the 60% equities, 40% bonds. If you take a look, as Frank talked about, if you're in bonds like TLT, you're getting killed right now. You're down 10, 15%, and that can get much worse as inflation heats up. So, investing in commodities, there's a number of ways you can do it. You can do it through a commodity ETF. You can do it in the futures market if you're an experienced trader, or you can buy the actual companies, which is what I prefer. And so, when you think of, I tend to be more of a macro investor. What I try to find, and I wrote about this a number of years ago in The Next Big Thing, I try to find the next cycle. What's going to be the thing? In the 00 decade, it was commodities. In the new decade, this one that we just went through, it was all about paper assets, stocks and bonds. This new decade, it's going to be, we're still going to be in technology. We're still going to be in healthcare because an aging population globally, but also commodities. So, I take a look at my theme and my portfolio. I'm probably a third in commodities, a third in technology, and a third in healthcare. Because I look for catalysts, things that are going to drive a long-term trend. And as we mentioned in the number of things that are driving commodities, decades of underinvestment, green energy, monetary fusion, environmentalism, and generational low in prices, that's a trend that I can grab onto. Technology, we're not going to stop inventing stuff. I mean, just take a look at all the stuff that came out in CES this year. Every year you're seeing new devices, new kind of technology take over the marketplace, as Frank was talking about, looking in below the FANG stocks and other technology type companies. And then if you take a look at global aging, not just here in the U.S., but in Europe and Asia. What does that require? As you get older, more healthcare. So those are three catalysts that I see over the next 10 years. Monetary debasement, lack of supplies driving commodities, technology going forward, and healthcare. So, you know, as I take a look at how I invest, that's where I'm putting my money.
Well, for all of you listening today, I want to point out that we're going to be publishing a three-part article by Jim going over some of this information and even more when it comes to the commodity supercycle related and how this is also related to some of the policy moves that we're seeing in terms of modern monetary theory, deficits, and a lot of other topics that we've been discussing on the show more recently. So definitely go to Financial Sense. Be sure to look out for that article. If you're not already a subscriber to our newsletter, you can definitely go to Financial Sense and sign up for that as well. And that will get emailed to you when we have it published on our site, along with a lot of our other materials and things that we publish on Financial Sense.
And just for all of you, over the years, we've had a number of requests for Frank Barbera, a good friend of mine, and we're pleased to announce that Frank Barbera has joined Financial Sense Wealth Management as a senior portfolio manager and will be a regular technician on the program every single month. So in the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, be safe. And have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.